He stepped out into the bedroom and looked at the clothes that had been laid out for him, considering them thoughtfully and wondering if he could put them on without error and without requiring robotic help. The storm and the night were over, and he wanted to assume the mantle of adulthood and independence once again. He said, "What is this?" He held up a long sash covered with an intricately colored arabesque. "It is a pajama sash," said Daniil. "It is purely ornamental. It passes over the left shoulder and is tied at the right side of the waist. It is traditionally worn at breakfast on some spacer worlds, but is not very popular on Aurora."
"Then why should I wear it?"
"Miss Gladiya thought it would become you, Partner Elijah. The method of tying is rather intricate, and I will be glad to help you."
"Jehoshaphat," thought Bailey ruefully. "She wants me to be pretty. What does she have in mind?"
"Don't think about it."
Bailey said,
"Never mind, I'll manage with a simple bow knot. But listen, Daniil, after breakfast, I will be going over to Fastolf's, where I will meet with him, with Amadiro, and with the chairman of the legislature. I don't know if there will be any others present."
"Yes, Partner Elijah, I am aware of that. I don't think there will be others present."
"Well, then," said Bailey, beginning to put on his undergarments, and doing it slowly so as to make no mistake and thus find it unnecessary to appeal for help to Daniil. "Tell me about the chairman. I know from my reading that he is the nearest thing to an executive officer that there is on Aurora, but I gathered from that same reading that the position is purely honorary. He has no power, I take it."
Daniil said, "I am afraid, Partner Elijah."
Giscard interrupted, "Sir, I am more aware of the political situation on Aurora than friend Daniil is. I have been in operation for much longer. Would you be willing to have me answer the question?"
"Why, certainly, Giscard. Go ahead."
"When the government of Aurora was first set up, sir," began Giscard in a didactic way, as though an information reel within him were methodically spinning, "it was intended that the executive officer fulfill only ceremonial duties. He was to greet dignitaries from other worlds, open all meetings of the legislature, preside over its deliberations, and vote only to break a tie. After the river controversy, however..."
"Yes, I read about that," said Bailey.
It had been a particularly dull episode in Auroran history in which impenetrable arguments over the proper division of hydroelectric power had led to the nearest approach to civil war the planet had ever seen.
"You needn't go into details."
"No, sir," said Giscard. "After the river controversy, however, there was a general determination never to allow controversy to endanger Auroran society again. It has become customary, therefore, to settle all disputes in a private and peaceable manner outside the legislature. When the legislators finally vote, it is in an agreed-upon fashion, so that there is always a large majority on one side or the other. The key figure in the settlement of disputes is the chairman of the legislature. He is held to be above the struggle, and his power, which although nil in theory is considerable in practice, only holds as long as he is seen to be so. The chairman, therefore, jealously guards his objectivity, and as long as he succeeds in this, it is he who usually makes the decision that settles any controversy in one direction or another."
Bailey said,
"You mean that the chairman will listen to me, to Fastolf, and to Amadiro, and then come to a decision?"
"Possibly. On the other hand, sir, he may remain uncertain and require further testimony, further thought, or both."
"And if the chairman does come to a decision, will Amadiro bow to it if it is against him, or will Fastolf bow if it is against him?"
"That is not an absolute necessity. There are almost always some who will not accept the chairman's decision, and both Dr. Amadiro and Dr. Fastolf are headstrong and obstinate individuals, if one may judge from their actions. Most of the legislators, however, will go along with the chairman's decision, whatever that might be. Dr. Fastolf or Dr. Amadiro, whichever it may be who will be decided against by the chairman, will then be sure to find himself in a small minority when the vote is taken."
"How sure, Giscard?"
"Almost sure.
The chairman's term of office is ordinarily 30 years, with the opportunity for a re-election by the legislature for another 30 years. If, however, a vote were to go against the chairman's recommendation, the chairman would be forced to resign forthwith, and there would be a governmental crisis while the legislature tried to find another chairman under conditions of bitter dispute. Few legislators are willing to risk that, and the chance of getting a majority to vote against the chairman, when that is the consequence, is almost nil.
Then, said Bailey ruefully, everything depends on this morning's conference.
That is very likely.
Thank you, Giscard.
Gloomily, Bailey arranged and rearranged his line of thought. It seemed hopeful to him, but he did not have any idea what Amadeiro might say or what the chairman might be like. It was Amadeiro who had initiated the meeting, and he must feel confident, sure of himself. It was then that Bailey remembered that once again, when he was falling asleep, with Gladia in his arms, he had seen, or thought he had seen, or imagined he had seen, the meaning of all the events on Aurora. Everything had seemed clear, obvious, certain. And once more, for the third time, it was gone as though it had never been. And with that thought, his hopes seemed to go too. 72. Danil led Bailey into the room where breakfast was being served. It seemed more intimate than an ordinary dining room. It was small and plain, with no more in the way of furnishings than a table and two chairs, and when Danil retired, he did not move into a niche. In fact, there were no niches, and for a moment Bailey found himself alone, entirely alone, in the room. That he was not really alone, he was certain. There would be robots on instant call. Still, it was a room for two. A no-robots room. A room, Bailey hesitated at the thought, for lovers. On the table there were two stacks of pancake-like objects that did not smell like pancakes, but smelled good. Two containers of what looked like melted butter, but might not be, flanked them. There was a pot of the hot drink, which Bailey had tried and had not liked very much, that substituted for coffee. Gladia walked in, dressed in rather prim fashion and with her hair glistening as though freshly conditioned. She paused a moment, her face wearing a half-smile.
Elijah?
Bailey, caught a little by surprise at the sudden appearance, jumped to his feet.
How are you, Gladia?
He stuttered a bit. She ignored that. She seemed cheerful, carefree. She said,
If you're worried about Danil not being in sight, don't be. He's completely safe, and he'll stay so. As for us...
She came to him, standing close, and put a hand slowly to his cheek, as once, long ago, she had done in Solaria. She laughed lightly.
That was all I did then, Elijah. Do you remember?
Elijah nodded silently.
Did you sleep well, Elijah? Oh, sit down, dear.
He sat down.
Very well. Thank you, Gladia.
He hesitated before deciding not to return the endearment in kind. She said,
Don't thank me. I've had my best night's sleep in weeks, and I wouldn't have if I hadn't gotten out of bed after I was sure you were sleeping soundly. If I had stayed, as I wanted to, I would have been annoying you before the night was over, and you would not have gotten your rest.
He recognized the need for gallantry.
There are some things more important than rest, Gladia, he said,
but with such formality that she laughed again.
Poor Elijah, she said. You're embarrassed.
The fact that she recognized that embarrassed him even more. Bailey had been prepared for contrition, disgust, shame, affected indifference, tears, everything but the frankly erotic attitude she had assumed. She said,
Well, don't suffer so. You're hungry. You hardly ate last night.
Get some calories inside you and you'll feel more carnal.
Bailey looked doubtfully at the pancakes that weren't. Gladiah said,
Oh, you've probably never seen these. They're Salarian delicacies, pachinkas. I had to reprogram my chef before he could make them properly. In the first place, you have to use imported Salarian grain. It won't work with the Auroran varieties. And they're stuffed. Actually, there are a thousand stuffings you can use, but this is my favorite, and I know you'll like it too. I won't tell you what's in it, except for chestnut puree and a touch of honey, but try it and tell me what you think. You can eat it with your fingers, but be careful how you bite into it.
She picked one up, holding it daintily between the thumb and middle finger of each hand, then took a small bite, slowly, and licked at the golden semi-liquid filling that flowed out. Bailey imitated her action. The pachinka was hard to the touch and not too hot to hold. He put one end cautiously in his mouth and found it resisted biting. He put more muscle into it, and the pachinka cracked, and he found the contents flowing over his hands.
The bite was too large and too forceful, said Gladiah,
rushing to him with a napkin.
Now, lick at it. No one eats a pachinka neatly. There's no such thing. You're supposed to wallow in it. Ideally, you're supposed to eat it in the nude, then take a shower.
Bailey tried a hesitant lick, and his expression was clear enough.
You like it, don't you?
Said Gladiah.
It's delicious,
said Bailey, and he bit away at it slowly and gently. It wasn't too sweet, and it seemed to soften and melt in the mouth. It scarcely required swallowing. He ate three pachinkas, and it was only shame that kept him from asking for more. He licked at his fingers without urging and eschewed the use of napkins, for he wanted none of it to be wasted on an inanimate object.
Dip your fingers and hands in the cleanser, Elijah,
and she showed him. The melted butter was a finger bowl, obviously. Bailey did as he was shown and then dried his hands. He sniffed at them, and there was no odor whatever. She said,
Are you embarrassed about last night, Elijah? Is that all you feel?
What did one say? Bailey wondered. Finally, he nodded.
I'm afraid I am, Gladiah. It's not all I feel by 20 kilometers or more, but I am embarrassed. Stop and think. I'm an Earthman, and you know that, but for the time being you're repressing it, and Earthman is only a meaningless disyllabic sound to you. Last night you were sorry for me, concerned over my problem with the storm, feeling toward me as you would toward a child, and sympathizing with me, perhaps, out of the vulnerability produced in you by your own loss, you came to me. But that feeling will pass. I'm surprised it hasn't passed already. And then you will remember that I am an Earthman, and you will feel ashamed, demeaned, and dirtied. You will hate me for what I have done for you, and I don't want to be hated. I don't want to be hated, Gladiah.
If he looked as unhappy as he felt, he looked unhappy indeed. She must have thought so, for she reached out to him and stroked his hand.
I won't hate you, Elijah. Why should I? You did nothing to me that I can object to. I did it to you, and I'll be glad for the rest of my life that I did. You freed me by a touch 2 years ago, Elijah. And last night you freed me again. I needed to know, 2 years ago, that I could feel desire, and last night I needed to know that I could feel desire again after Jander. Elijah, stay with me. It would be...
He cut her off earnestly.
How can that be, Gladiah? I must go back to my own world. I have duties and goals there, and you cannot come with me. You could not live the kind of life that is lived on Earth. You would die of earthly diseases if the crowds and enclosure did not kill you first. Surely you understand.
I understand about Earth,
said Gladiah with a sigh.
But surely you needn't leave immediately.
Before the morning is over, I may be ordered off the planet by the chairman.
You won't be, said Gladiah energetically. You won't let yourself be. And if you are, we can go to another spacer world. There are dozens we can choose from. Does Earth mean so much to you that you wouldn't live on a spacer world?
Bailey said, I could be evasive, Gladiah, and point out that no other spacer world would let me make my home there permanently, and you know that's so. The greater truth is, though, that even if some spacer world would accept me, Earth means so much to me that I would have to return, even if it meant leaving you.
And never visiting Aurora again? Never seeing me again?
If I could see you again, I would,
Bailey said, wishing.
Over and over again, believe me. But what's the use of saying so? You know I'm not likely to be invited back, and you know I can't return without an invitation.
Gladiah said in a low voice,
I don't want to believe that, Elijah.
Bailey said,
Gladiah, don't make yourself unhappy. Something wonderful happened between us, but there are other wonderful things that will happen to you too, many of them of all kinds, but not the same wonderful thing. Look forward to the others.
She was silent.
Gladiah,
he said urgently,
need anyone know what has happened between us?
She looked up at him, a pained expression on her face.
Are you that ashamed?
Of what happened? Certainly not. But even though I am not ashamed, there could be consequences that would be discomforting. The matter would be talked about. Thanks to that hateful hyperwave drama, which included a distorted view of our relationship, we are news. The Earthman and the Solarian woman. If there is the slightest reason to suspect that there is love between us, it will get back to Earth at the speed of hyperspatial drive.
Gladiah lifted her eyebrows with a touch of hauteur.
And Earth will consider you demeaned. You will have indulged in sex with someone beneath your station.
No, of course not,
said Bailey uneasily, for he knew that that would certainly be the view of billions of Earth people.
Has it occurred to you that my wife would hear of it? I'm married.
And if she does, what of it?
Bailey took a deep breath.
You don't understand. Earth ways are not spacer ways. We have had times in our history when sexual mores were fairly loose, at least in some places and for some classes. This is not one of those times. Earthmen live crowded together, and it takes a Puritan ethic to keep the family system stable under such conditions.
Everyone has one partner, you mean, and no other?
No, said Bailey. To be honest, that's not so, but care is taken to keep irregularities sufficiently quiet so that everyone can
pretend they don't know.
Well, yes, but in this case,
it will all be so public that no one could pretend not to know. And your wife will be angry with you and will strike you.
No, she won't strike me. But she will be shamed, which is worse. I will be shamed as well, and so will my son. My social position will suffer, and... Gladiah, if you don't understand, you don't understand, but tell me that you will not speak freely of this thing, as Aurorans do.
He was conscious of making a rather miserable show of himself. Gladiah said thoughtfully,
I do not mean to tease you, Elijah. You have been kind to me, and I would not be unkind to you.
She threw her arms up hopelessly.
Your Earth ways are so nonsensical.
Undoubtedly. Yet I must live with them, as you have lived with Solarian ways.
Yes.
Her expression darkened with memory. Then,
forgive me, Elijah. Really and honestly, I apologize. I want what I can't have, and I take it out on you.
It's all right.
No, it's not all right. Please, Elijah, I must explain something to you. I don't think you understand what happened last night. Will you be all the more embarrassed if I do?
Bailey wondered how Jessie would feel and what she would do if she could hear this conversation. Bailey was quite aware that his mind should be on the confrontation with the chairman that was looming immediately up ahead, and not on his own personal marital dilemma. He should be thinking of Earth's danger and not of his wife's, but in actual fact, he was thinking of Jessie. He said,
"I'll probably be embarrassed, but explain it anyway."
Gladiah moved her chair, refraining from calling one of her robotic staff to do it for her. He waited for her nervously, not offering to move it himself. She put her chair immediately next to his, facing it in the other direction, so that she was looking at him directly when she sat down. And as she did so, she put out her small hand and placed it in his, and he felt his own hand press it.
"You see," she said, "I no longer fear contact. I'm no longer at the stage where all I can do is brush your cheek for an instant."
"That may be, but this does not affect you, Gladiah, does it, as that bare touch did then?"
She nodded.
"No, it doesn't affect me that way. But I like it anyway. I think that's an advance, actually. To be turned inside out just by a single moment of touch shows how abnormally I had lived and for how long. Now it is better. May I tell you how? What I have just said is actually prologue."
"Tell me."
"I wish we were in bed and it was dark. I could talk more freely."
"We are sitting up and it is light, Gladiah. But I am listening."
"Yes. On Solaria, Elisha, there was no sex to speak of. You know that."
"Yes, I do."
"I experienced none in any real sense. On a few occasions, only a few, my husband approached me out of duty. I won't even describe how that was, but you will believe me when I tell you that, looking back on it, it was worse than none."
"I believe you."
"But I knew about sex. I read about it. I discussed it with other women sometimes, all of whom pretended it was a hateful duty that Solarians must undergo. If they had children to the limit of their quota, they always said they were delighted they would never have to deal with sex again."
"Did you believe them?"
"Of course I did. I had never heard anything else, and the few non-Solarian accounts I read were denounced as false distortions. I believed that, too. My husband found some books I had, called them pornography, and had them destroyed. Then, too, you know, people can make themselves believe anything. I think Solarian women believed what they said and really did despise sex. They certainly sounded sincere enough, and it made me feel there was something terribly wrong with me because I had a kind of curiosity about it and odd feelings I could not understand."
"You did not, at that time, use robots for relief in any way?"
"No, it didn't occur to me. Or any inanimate object. There were occasional whispers of such things, but with such horror, or pretended horror, that I would never dream of doing anything like that. Of course, I had dreams, and sometimes something that, as I look back on it, must have been incipient orgasms, would wake me. I never understood them, of course, or dared talk of it. I was bitterly ashamed of it, in fact. Worse, I was frightened of the pleasure they brought me. And then, of course, I came to Aurora."
"You told me of that. Sex with Aurorans was unsatisfactory."
"Yes. It made me think that Solarians were right after all. Sex was not like my dreams at all. It was not until Jander that I understood. It is not sex that they have on Aurora. It is choreography. Every step of it is dictated by fashion, from the method of approach to the moment of departure. There is nothing unexpected, nothing spontaneous. On Solaria, since there was so little sex, nothing was given or taken. And on Aurora, sex was so stylized that, in the end, nothing was given or taken either. Do you understand?
I'm not sure, Gladiah. Never having experienced sex with an Auroran woman, or for that matter, never having been an Auroran man, but it's not necessary to explain. I have a dim notion of what you mean.
You're terribly embarrassed, aren't you?
Not to the point of being unable to listen.
But then I met Jander and learned to use him. He was not an Auroran man. His only aim, his only possible aim, was to please me. He gave, and I took. And for the first time, I experienced sex as it should be experienced. Do you understand that? Can you imagine what it must be like suddenly to know that you are not mad or distorted or perverted or even simply wrong, but to know that you are a woman and have a satisfying sex partner?
I think I can imagine that.
And then, after so short a time, to have it all taken away from me. I thought that that was the end. I was doomed. I was never again, through centuries of life, to have a good sexual relationship again. Not to have had it to start with, and then never to have had it at all, was bad enough. But to get it against all expectation, and to have it, then suddenly to lose it and go back to nothing, that was unbearable. You see how important, therefore, last night was.
But why me, Gladiah? Why not someone else?
No, Elijah. It had to be you. We came and found you, Giscard and I, and you were helpless, truly helpless. You were not unconscious, but you did not rule your body. You had to be lifted and carried and placed in the car. I was there when you were warmed and treated, bathed and dried, helpless throughout. The robots did it all with marvelous efficiency, intent on caring for you and preventing harm from coming to you, but totally without actual feeling. I, on the other hand, watched, and I felt.
Bailey bent his head, gritting his teeth at the thought of his public helplessness. He had luxuriated in it when it had happened, but now he could only feel the disgrace of being observed under such conditions. She went on.
I wanted to do it all for you. I resented the robots for reserving for themselves the right to be kind to you and to give. And as I thought of myself doing it, I felt a growing sexual excitement, something I hadn't felt since Jander's death. And it occurred to me then that, in my only successful sex, what I had done was to take. Jander gave whatever I wished, but he never took. He was incapable of taking, since his only pleasure lay in pleasing me. And it never occurred to me to give because I was brought up with robots and knew they couldn't take. And as I watched, it came to me that I knew only half of sex, and I desperately wanted to experience the other half. But then at the dinner table with me afterward, when you were eating your hot soup, you seemed recovered. You seemed strong. You were strong enough to console me, and because I had had that feeling for you when you were being cared for, I no longer feared your being from Earth, and I was willing to move into your embrace. I wanted it. But even as you held me, I felt a sense of loss, for I was taking again and not giving. And you said to me, Gladiah, please, I must sit down. Elisha, it was the most wonderful thing you could have said to me.
Bailey felt himself flush.
It embarrassed me hideously at the time. Such a confession of weakness.
It was just what I wanted. It drove me wild with desire. I forced you to bed, and came to you, and for the first time in my life I gave. I took nothing. And the spell of Jander passed, for I knew that he had not been enough either. It must be possible to take and give both. Elijah, stay with me.
Bailey shook his head.
Gladiah, if I tore my heart in two, it wouldn't change the facts. I cannot remain on Aurora. I must return to Earth. You cannot come to Earth.
Elijah, what if I can come to Earth?
Why do you say such a foolish thing? Even if you could, I would age quickly and soon be useless to you. In 20 years, 30 at the most, I will be an old man, probably dead, while you will stay as you are for centuries.
But that is what I mean, Elijah. On Earth I will catch your infections, and I will grow old quickly too.
You wouldn't want that. Besides, old age isn't an infection. You will merely grow sick very quickly and die. Gladiah, you can find another man.
An Auroran?
She said it with contempt.
You can teach. Now that you know how to take and to give, teach them how to do both as well.
If I teach, will they learn?
Some will. Surely some will. You have so much time to find the one who will. There is...
No, he thought. It is not wise to mention Grimianus now, but perhaps if he comes to her, less politely and with a little more determination. She seemed thoughtful.
Is it possible?
Then, looking at Bailey with her gray-blue eyes moist,
Oh, Elijah, do you remember anything at all of what happened last night?
I must admit,
said Bailey a little sadly,
that some of it is distressingly hazy.
If you remembered, you would not want to leave me.
I don't want to leave you as it is, Gladiah. It is just that I must.
And afterward,
she said,
you seemed so quietly happy, so rested. I lay nestled on your shoulder and felt your heart beat rapidly at first, then more and more slowly, except when you sat up so suddenly. Do you remember that?
Bailey started and leaned a little away from her, gazing into her eyes wildly.
No, I don't remember that. What do you mean? What did I do?
I told you. You sat up suddenly.
Yes, but what else?
His heart was beating rapidly now, as rapidly as it must have in the wake of last night's sex. 3 times, something that had seemed the truth had come to him, but the first 2 times he had been entirely alone. The 3rd time, last night, however, Gladiah had been with him. He had had a witness. Gladiah said,
Well, nothing else, really. I said, What is it, Elijah? But you paid no attention to me. You said, I have it. I have it. You didn't speak clearly, and your eyes were unfocused. It was a little frightening.
Is that all I said? Jehoshaphat, Gladiah, didn't I say anything more?
Gladiah frowned.
I don't remember, but then you lay back, and I said, Don't be frightened, Elijah. Don't be frightened. You're safe now. And I stroked you, and you settled back and fell asleep. And snored. I never heard anyone snore before, but that's what it must have been from the descriptions.
The thought clearly amused her. Bailey said,
Listen to me, Gladiah. What did I say? I have it. I have it. Did I say what it was I had?
She frowned again.
No. I don't remember. Wait, you did say one thing in a very low voice. You said, He was there first.
He was there first. That's what I said?
Yes. I took it for granted that you meant Giscard was there before the other robots, that you were trying to overcome your fears of being taken away, that you were reliving that time in the storm. Yes, that's why I stroked you and said, Don't be frightened, Elijah. You're safe now. till you relaxed.
He was there first. He was there first. I won't forget it now. Gladiya, thanks for last night. Thanks for talking to me now.
Gladiya said, Is there something important about you saying that Giskard found you first? He did, you know that.
It can't be that, Gladiya. It must be something I don't know, but manage to discover only when my mind is totally relaxed.
But what does it mean, then?
I'm not sure. But if that's what I said, it must mean something. And I have an hour or so to figure it out. He stood up. I must leave now.
He had taken a few steps toward the door, but Gladiya flew to him and put her arms around him.
Wait, Elisha.
Bailey hesitated, then lowered his head to kiss her. For a long moment, they clung together.
Will I see you again, Elisha?
Bailey said sadly.
I can't say. I hope so.
And he went off to find Daniil and Giskard so that he could make the necessary preparations for the confrontation about to come. 73. Bailey's sadness persisted as he walked across the long lawn to Fastolf's establishment. The robots walked on either side. Daniil seemed at his ease, but Giskard, faithful to his programming and apparently unable to relax it, maintained his close watch on the surroundings. Bailey said,
What is the name of the chairman of the legislature, Daniil?
I cannot say, Partner Elijah. On the occasions when he has been referred to in my hearing, he has been referred to only as the chairman. He is addressed as Mr. Chairman.
Giskard said,
His name is Rutelin Horder, sir, but it is never mentioned officially. The title alone is used. That serves to impress continuity on the government. Human holders of the position have individually fixed terms, but the chairman always exists.
And this particular individual chairman, how old is he?
Quite old, sir. 331, said Giskard, who typically had statistics on tap.
In good health?
I know nothing to the contrary, sir.
Any outstanding personal characteristics it might be well for me to be prepared for?
That seemed to stop Giskard. He said, after a pause,
That is difficult for me to say, sir. He is in his second term. He is considered an efficient chairman who works hard and gets results.
Well, is he short-tempered, patient, domineering, understanding?
Giskard said,
You must judge such things for yourself, sir.
Daniil said,
Partner Elijah, the chairman is above partisanship. He is just and even-handed by definition.
I'm sure of that, muttered Bailey. But definitions are abstract, as is the chairman, while individual chairmen, with names, are concrete and may have minds to match.
He shook his head.
His own mind, he would swear, had a strong measure of concrete itself.
Having three times thought of something and three times lost it, he was now presented with his own comment at the time of having the thought, and it still didn't help.
He was there first.
Who was there first? When? Bailey had no answer. 74. Bailey found Fastolf waiting for him at the door of his establishment, with a robot behind him who seemed most unrobotically restless, as though unable to perform his proper function of greeting a visitor and upset by the fact. But then one was always reading human motivations and responses into robots. What was more likely true was no upsetness, no feeling of any kind, merely a slight oscillation of positronic potentials resulting from the fact that his orders were to greet and inspect all visitors, and he could not quite perform the task without pushing past Fastolf, which he also could not do in the absence of overriding necessity. So he made false starts, one after the other, and that made him seem restless. Bailey found himself staring at the robot absently, and only with difficulty managing to bring his eyes back to Fastolf.
He was thinking of robots, but he didn't know why.
"I'm glad to see you again, Dr. Fastolf," he said, and thrust his hand forward.
After his encounter with Gladiah, it was rather difficult to remember that spacers were reluctant to make physical contact with an Earthman. Fastolf hesitated a moment, and then, as manners triumphed over prudence, he took the hand offered him, held it lightly and briefly, and let it go. He said,
"I am even more delighted to see you, Mr. Bailey. I was quite alarmed over your experience last evening. It was not a particularly bad storm, but to an Earthman it must have seemed overwhelming.
You know about what happened, then?"
"Daniil and Giscard had brought me fully up to date in that respect. I would have felt better if they had come here directly and eventually brought you here with them, but their decision was based on the fact that Gladiah's establishment was closer to the breakdown point of the airfoil and that your orders had been extremely intense and had placed Daniil's safety ahead of your own. They did not misinterpret you?"
"They did not. I forced them to leave me."
"Was that wise?"
Fastolf led the way indoors and pointed to a chair. Bailey sat down.
"It seemed the proper thing to do. We were being pursued."
"So Giscard reported. He also reported that—"
Bailey intervened. "Dr. Fastolf, please, I have very little time and I have questions that I must ask you."
"Go ahead, please,"
said Fastolf at once, with his usual air of unfailing politeness. "It has been suggested that you place your work on brain function above everything else, that you—"
"Let me finish, Mr. Bailey. That I will let nothing stand in my way, that I am totally ruthless, oblivious to any consideration of immorality or evil, would stop at nothing, would excuse everything, all in the name of the importance of my work."
"Yes."
"Who told you this, Mr. Bailey?"
asked Fastolf. "Does it matter?"
"Perhaps not. Besides, it's not difficult to guess. It was my daughter Vasilia. I'm sure of that."
Bailey said,
"Perhaps. What I want to know is whether this estimate of your character is correct."
Fastolf smiled sadly.
"Do you expect an honest answer from me about my own character? In some ways, the accusations against me are true. I do consider my work the most important matter there is, and I do have the impulse to sacrifice anything and everything to it. I would ignore conventional notions of evil and immorality if these got in my way. The thing is, however, that I don't. I can't bring myself to. And in particular, if I have been accused of killing Jander because that would in some way advance my study of the human brain, I deny it. It is not so. I did not kill Jander."
Bailey said, "You suggested I submit to a psychic probe to get some information that I can't reach otherwise out of my brain. Has it occurred to you that if you submitted to a psychic probe, your innocence could be demonstrated?" Fastolf nodded his head thoughtfully.
"I imagine Vasilia suggested that my failure to offer to submit to one was proof of my guilt. Not so. A psychic probe is dangerous, and I am as nervous about submitting myself to one as you are. Still, I would have done so, despite my fears, were it not for the fact that is what my opponents would most like to have me do. They would argue against any evidence to my innocence, and the psychic probe is not delicate enough an instrument to demonstrate innocence beyond argument. But what they would get by use of the probe is information about the theory and design of humaniform robots. That is what they are after, and that is what I am not going to give them."
Bailey said,
"Very well. Thank you, Dr. Fastolf."
Fastolf said,
"You are welcome. And now, if I may get back to what I was saying, Giscard reported that after you were left alone in the airfoil, you were accosted by strange robots. At least you spoke of strange robots, rather disjointedly, after you were found unconscious and exposed to the storm."
"The strange robots did accost me, Dr. Fastolf. I managed to deflect them and send them away, but I thought it wise to leave the airfoil rather than await their return. I may not have been thinking clearly when I reached that decision. Giscard said I was not."
Fastolf smiled.
Giscard has a simplistic view of the universe. Have you any idea whose robots they were?
Bailey moved about restlessly and seemed to find no way of adjusting himself to the seat in a comfortable manner. He said,
Has the chairman arrived yet?
No, but he will be here momentarily. So will Amadiro, the head of the Institute, whom the robots told me you met yesterday. I am not sure that was wise. You irritated him.
I had to see him, Dr. Fastolf, and he did not seem irritated.
That is no guide with Amadiro. As a result of what he calls your slanders and your unbearable sullying of professional reputation, he has forced the chairman's hand.
In what way?
It is the chairman's job to encourage the meeting of contending parties and to work for a compromise. If Amadiro wishes to meet with me, the chairman could not, by definition, discourage it, much less forbid it. He must hold the meeting, and if Amadiro can find enough evidence against you, and it is easy to find evidence against an Earthman, that will end the investigation.
Perhaps, Dr. Fastolf, you should not have called on an Earthman to help, considering how vulnerable we are.
Perhaps not, Mr. Bailey. But I could think of nothing else to do. I still can't. So I must leave it up to you to persuade the chairman to our point of view, if you can.
The responsibility is mine, said Bailey glumly.
Entirely yours,
said Fastolf smoothly. Bailey said, Are we four to be the only ones present? Fastolf said,
Actually, we three. The chairman, Amadiro, and myself. We are the two principals and the compromising agent, so to speak. You will be there as a fourth party, Mr. Bailey, only on sufferance. The chairman can order you to leave at will, so I hope you will not do anything to upset him.
I'll try not to, Dr. Fastolf.
For instance, Mr. Bailey, do not offer him your hand, if you will forgive my rudeness.
Bailey felt himself grow warm with retroactive embarrassment at his earlier gesture.
I will not.
And be unfailingly polite. Make no angry accusations. Do not insist on statements for which there is no support.
You mean don't try to stampede anyone into betraying himself. Amadiro, for instance.
Yes, do not do so. You will be committing slander, and it will be counterproductive. Therefore, be polite. If the politeness masks an attack, we won't quarrel with that. And try not to speak unless you are spoken to.
Bailey said,
How is it, Dr. Fastolf, that you are so full of careful advice now, and yet you never warned me about the dangers of slander earlier?
The fault is indeed mine, said Dr. Fastolf. It was a matter of such basic knowledge to me that it never occurred to me that it had to be explained.
Bailey grunted.
Yes, I thought so.
Fastolf raised his head suddenly.
I hear an airfoil outside. More than that, I can hear the steps of one of my staff heading for the entrance. I presume the chairman and Amadiro are at hand.
Together? Asked Bailey.
Undoubtedly. You see, Amadiro suggested my establishment as the meeting place, thus granting me the advantage of home ground. He will therefore have the chance of offering, out of apparent politeness, to call for the chairman and bring him here. After all, they must both come here. This will give him a few minutes to talk privately with the chairman and push his point of view.
Oh, that is scarcely fair, said Bailey.
Could you have stopped that?
I didn't want to. Amadiro takes a calculated risk. He may say something that will irritate the chairman.
Is the chairman particularly irritable by nature?
No. No more so than any chairman in the fifth decade of his term of office. Still, the necessity of strict adherence to protocol, the further necessity of never taking sides, and the actuality of arbitrary power, all combine toward making a certain irritability inevitable. And Amadiro is not always wise. His jovial smile, his white teeth, his exuding bonhomie can be extremely irritating when those upon whom he lavishes it are not in a good mood, for some reason. But I must go meet them, Mr. Bailey, and supply what I hope will be a more substantial version of charm. Please stay here, and don't move from that chair.
Bailey could do nothing but wait now. He thought, irrelevantly, that he had been on Aurora for just a bit short of 50 standard hours. Chapter 18. Again the Chairman. 75. The chairman was short, surprisingly short. Amadeiro towered over him by nearly 30 centimeters. However, since most of his shortness was in his thighs, the chairman, when all were seated, was not noticeably inferior in height to the others. Indeed, he was thick-set, with a massive chest and shoulders, and looked almost overpowering under those conditions. His head was large, too, but his face was lined and marked by age. Nor were its wrinkles the kindly type carved by laughter. They were impressed into his cheeks and forehead, one felt, by the exercise of power. His hair was white and sparse, and he was bald in the spot where the hairs would have met in a whorl. His voice suited him, deep and decisive. Age had robbed it of some of its timbre, perhaps, and lent it a bit of harshness, but in a chairman, Bailey thought, that might help rather than hinder. Fastolf went through the full ritual of greeting, exchanged stroking remarks without meaning, and offered food and drink. Through all of this, no mention was made of the outsider, and no notice was taken of him. It was only when the preliminaries were finished and when all were seated that Bailey, a little farther from the center than the others, was introduced. He said, "Mr. Chairman," without holding out his hand. Then, with an offhand nod, he said, "And of course I've met Dr. Amadeiro." Amadeiro's smile did not waver at the touch of insolence in Bailey's voice. The chairman, who had not acknowledged Bailey's greeting, placed his hands on each knee, fingers spread apart, and said,
"Let us get started, and let us see if we can't make this as brief and as productive as possible. Let me stress first that I wish to get past this matter of the misbehavior or possible misbehavior of an Earthman, and strike instantly to the heart of the matter. Nor in dealing with the heart of the matter are we speaking of this overblown matter of the robot. Disrupting the activity of a robot is a matter for the civil courts. It can result in a judgment of the infringement of property rights and the inflicting of a penalty of costs, but nothing more than that. What's more, if it should be proved that Dr. Fastolf had rendered the robot, Jander Pennell, inoperable, it is a robot who, after all, he helped design, whose construction he supervised, and the ownership of whom he held at the time of the inoperability. No penalty is likely to apply, since a person may do what he likes with his own. What is really at issue is the matter of the exploration and settlement of the galaxy. Whether we of Aurora carry it through alone, whether we do it in collaboration with the other spacer worlds, or whether we leave it to Earth. Dr. Amadeiro and the globalists favor having Aurora shoulder the burden alone. Dr. Fastolf wishes to leave it to Earth. If we can settle this matter, then the affair of the robot can be left to the civil courts, and the question of the Earthman's behavior will probably become moot, and we can simply get rid of him. Therefore, let me begin by asking whether Dr. Amadeiro is prepared to accept Dr. Fastolf's position in order to achieve unity of decision, or whether Dr. Fastolf is prepared to accept Dr. Amadeiro's position with the same end in view."
He paused and waited. Amadeiro said,
"I am sorry, Mr. Chairman, but I must insist that Earthmen be confined to their planet and that the galaxy be settled by Aurorans only. I would be willing to compromise, however, to the extent of allowing other spacer worlds to share in the settlement, if that would prevent needless strife among us."
"I see," said the chairman. "Will you, Dr. Fastolf, in view of this statement, abandon your position?"
Fastolf said,
Dr. Amadeiro's compromise has scarcely anything of substance in it, Mr. Chairman. I am willing to offer a compromise of greater significance. Why should not the worlds of the galaxy be thrown open to spacers and Earth people alike? The galaxy is large, and there would be room for both. I would be willing to accept such an arrangement.
No doubt,
said Amadeiro quickly,
for it is no compromise. The over 8 billion population of Earth is more than half again the population of all the spacer worlds combined. Earth's people are short-lived and are used to replacing their losses quickly. They lack our regard for individual human life. They will swarm over the new worlds at any cost, multiplying like insects, and will preempt the galaxy even while we are making a bare beginning. To offer Earth a supposedly equal chance at the galaxy is to give them the galaxy, and that is not equality. Earth people must be confined to Earth.
And what have you to say to that, Dr. Fastolf?
Asked the chairman. Fastolf sighed.
My views are on record. I'm sure I don't need to repeat them. Dr. Amadeiro plans to use humaniform robots to build the settled worlds that human Aurorans will then enter, ready-made, yet he doesn't even have humaniform robots. He cannot construct them, and the project would not work even if he did have them. No compromise is possible unless Dr. Amadeiro consents to the principle that Earth people may at least share in the task of the settlement of new worlds.
Then no compromise is possible,
said Amadeiro. The chairman looked displeased.
I'm afraid that one of you two must give in. I do not intend Aurora to be torn apart in an emotional orgy on a question this important.
He looked at Amadeiro blankly, his expression carefully signifying neither favor nor disfavor.
You intend to use the inoperability of the robot gender as an argument against Fastolf's view, do you not?
I do,
said Amadeiro.
A purely emotional argument. You are going to claim that Fastolf is trying to destroy your view by falsely making humaniform robots appear less useful than they, in effect, are.
That is exactly what he is trying to do,
slander,
put in Fastolf in a low voice.
Not if I can prove it, which I can,
said Amadeiro.
The argument may be an emotional one, but it will be effective. You see that, Mr. Chairman, don't you? My view will surely win, but left to itself, it will be messy. I would suggest that you persuade Dr. Fastolf to accept inevitable defeat and spare Aurora the enormous sadness of a spectacle that will weaken our position among the spacer worlds and shake our own belief in ourselves.
How can you prove that Dr. Fastolf rendered the robot inoperative?
He himself admits he is the only human being who could have done so. You know this.
I know, said the chairman. But I wanted to hear you say this, not to your constituency, not to the media, but to me, in private. And you have done so.
He turned to Fastolf.
And what do you say, Dr. Fastolf? Are you the only man who could have destroyed the robot?
Without leaving physical marks, I am, as far as I know. I don't believe that Dr. Amadeiro has the skill in robotics to do so, and I am constantly amazed that, after having founded his robotics institute, he is so eager to proclaim his own incapacity, even with all his associates at his back, and to do so publicly.
He smiled at Amadeiro, not entirely without malice. The chairman sighed.
No, Dr. Fastolf. No rhetorical tricks now. Let us dispense with sarcasm and clever thrusts. What is your defense?
Why, only that I did no harm to gender. I do not say anyone did. It was chance, the uncertainty principle at work on the positronic pathways. It can happen every so often. Let Dr. Amadeiro merely admit that it was chance, that no one be accused without evidence, and we can then argue the competing proposals about settlement on their own merits.
No,
said Amadeiro.
The chance of accidental destruction is too small to be considered, far smaller than the chance that Dr. Fastolf is responsible. So much smaller that to ignore Dr. Fastolf's guilt is irresponsible. I will not back down, and I will win. Mr. Chairman, you know I will win, and it seems to me that the only rational step to be taken is to force Dr. Fastolf to accept his defeat in the interest of global unity.
Fastolf said quickly,
And that brings me to the matter of the investigation I have asked Mr. Bailey of Earth to undertake.
And Amadeiro said, just as quickly,
A move I opposed when it was first suggested. The Earthman may be a clever investigator, but he is unfamiliar with Aurora and can accomplish nothing here. Nothing, that is, except to strew slander and to hold Aurora up to the spacer worlds in an undignified and ridiculous light. There have been satirical pieces on the matter in half a dozen important spacer hyperwave news programs on as many different worlds. Recordings of these have been sent to your office.
And have been brought to my attention, said the chairman.
And there has been murmuring here on Aurora,
Amadeiro drove on.
It would be to my selfish interest to allow the investigation to continue. It is costing Fastolf support among the populace and votes among the legislators. The longer it continues, the more certain I am of victory, but it is damaging Aurora, and I do not wish to add to my certainty at the cost of harm to my world. I suggest, with respect, that you end the investigation, Mr. Chairman, and persuade Dr. Fastolf to submit gracefully now to what he will eventually have to accept at much greater cost.
The chairman said,
I agree that to have permitted Dr. Fastolf to set up this investigation may have been unwise. I say may. I admit I am tempted to end it, and yet the Earthman...
He gave no indication of knowing that Bailey was in the room.
"Has already been here for some time."
He paused, as though to give Fastolf a chance for corroboration, and Fastolf took it, saying,
"This is the third day of his investigation, Mr. Chairman."
"In that case,"
said the chairman,
"before I end that investigation, it would be fair, I believe, to ask if there have been any significant findings so far."
He paused again. Fastolf glanced quickly at Bailey and made a small motion of his head. Bailey said in a low voice,
"I do not wish, Mr. Chairman, to obtrude, unasked, any observations. Am I being asked a question?"
The chairman frowned. Without looking at Bailey, he said,
"I am asking Mr. Bailey of Earth to tell us whether he has any findings of significance."
Bailey took a deep breath. This was it. 76.
"Mr. Chairman," he began, "yesterday afternoon I was interrogating Dr. Amadeiro, who was most cooperative and useful to me. When my staff and I left..."
"Your staff?"
asked the chairman. "I was accompanied by two robots on all phases of my investigation, Mr. Chairman," said Bailey.
"Robots who belong to Dr. Fastolf?"
asked Amadeiro.
"I ask this for the record."
"For the record, they do," said Bailey. "One is Daniil Oliva, a humaniform robot, and the other is Giskard Reventlov, an older, non-humaniform robot."
"Thank you,"
said the chairman.
"Continue."
"When we left the Institute grounds, we found that the airfoil we used had been tampered with."
"Tampered with?"
asked the chairman, startled.
"By whom?"
"We don't know, but it happened on Institute grounds. We were there by invitation, so it was known by the Institute personnel that we would be there. Moreover, no one else would be likely to be there without the invitation and knowledge of the Institute staff. If it were at all thinkable, it would be necessary to conclude that the tampering could only have been done by someone on the Institute staff, and that would in any case be impossible, except at the direction of Dr. Amadeiro himself, which would also be unthinkable." Amadeiro said,
"Well, you seem to think a great deal about the unthinkable. Has the aerofoil been examined by a qualified technician to see if it has indeed been tampered with? Might there not have been a natural failing?"
asked Amadeiro. "No, sir," said Bailey. But Giscard, who is qualified to drive an airfoil and who has frequently driven that particular one, maintains that it was tampered with.
And he is one of Dr. Fastolf's staff, and is programmed by him and receives his daily orders from him,
said Amadeiro.
Are you suggesting?
Began Fastolf.
I am suggesting nothing.
Amadeiro held up his hand in a benign gesture.
I am merely making a statement for the record.
The chairman stirred.
Well, Mr. Bailey of Earth, please continue.
Bailey said, when the airfoil broke down, there were others in pursuit.
Others?
Asked the chairman.
Other robots.
They arrived, and by that time my robots were gone.
One moment, said Amadeiro. What was your condition at the time, Mr. Bailey?
I was not entirely well.
Not entirely well? You are an Earthman, and unaccustomed to life except in the artificial setting of your cities. You are uneasy in the open. Is that not so, Mr. Bailey?
Asked Amadeiro.
Yes, sir. And there was a severe thunderstorm in progress last evening, as I'm sure the chairman recalls. Would it not be accurate to say that you were quite ill? Semi-conscious, if not worse?
I was quite ill, said Bailey, reluctantly.
Then how is it your robots were gone?
Asked the chairman sharply.
Should they not have been with you in your illness?
I ordered them away, Mr. Chairman.
Why?
I thought it best, said Bailey, and I will explain, if I may be allowed to continue.
Continue.
We were indeed being pursued, for the pursuing robots arrived shortly after my robots had left. The pursuers asked me where my robots were, and I told them I had sent them away. It was only after that that they asked if I were ill. I said I wasn't ill, and they left me in order to continue a search for my robots.
In search of Daniil and Giscard?
Asked the chairman.
Yes, Mr. Chairman. It was clear to me that they were under intense orders to find the robots.
In what way was that clear?
Although I was obviously ill, they asked about the robots before they asked about me. Then later they abandoned me in my illness to search for my robots. They must have received enormously intense orders to find those robots, or it would not have been possible for them to disregard a patently ill human being. As a matter of fact, I had anticipated this search for my robots, and that was why I had sent them away. I felt it all important to keep them out of unauthorized hands.
Amadeiro said,
Mr. Chairman, may I continue to question Mr. Bailey on this point in order to show the worthlessness of this statement?
You may.
Amadeiro said,
Mr. Bailey, you were alone after your robots had left, were you not?
Yes, sir.
Therefore, you have no recording of events. You are not yourself equipped to record them. You have no recording device.
No to all three, sir.
And you were ill?
Yes, sir.
Distraught? Possibly too ill to remember clearly?
No, sir, I remember quite clearly.
You would think so, I suppose, but you may well have been delirious and hallucinating. Under those conditions, it seems clear that what the robots said, or indeed whether robots appeared at all, would seem highly dubious.
The chairman said thoughtfully,
I agree. Mr. Bailey of Earth, assuming that what you remember, or claim to remember, is accurate, what is your interpretation of the events you are describing?
I hesitate to give you my thoughts on the matter, Mr. Chairman, said Bailey, lest I slander the worthy Dr. Amadeiro.
Since you speak at my request, and since your remarks are confined to this room,
the chairman looked around. The wall niches were empty of robots.
There is no question of slander, unless it seems to me you speak with malice.
In that case, Mr. Chairman, said Bailey, I thought it possible that Dr. Amadeiro detained me in his office by discussing matters with me at greater length than was perhaps necessary, so that there would be time for the damaging of my machine, then detained me further in order that I might leave after the thunderstorm had begun, thus making sure that I would be ill in transit. He had studied Earth's social conditions, as he told me several times, so he would know what my reaction to the storm might be.
It seemed to me that it was his plan to send his robots after us, and, when they came upon our stalled airfoil, to have them take us all back to the Institute grounds, presumably so that I might be treated for my illness, but actually so that he might have Dr. Fastolf's robots. Amadeiro laughed gently.
What motive am I supposed to have for all this? You see, Mr. Chairman, that this is supposition joined to supposition and would be judged slander in any court on Aurora.
The chairman said severely,
Has Mr. Bailey of Earth anything to support these hypotheses?
A line of reasoning, Mr. Chairman.
The chairman stood up, at once losing some of his presence, since he scarcely unfolded to a greater than sitting height.
Let me take a short walk so that I might consider what I have heard so far. I will be right back.
He left for the personal. Fastolf leaned in the direction of Bailey, and Bailey met him halfway. Amadeiro looked on in casual unconcern, as though it scarcely mattered to him what they might have to say to each other. Fastolf whispered,
Have you anything better to say?
Bailey said, I think so, if I get the proper chance to say it. But the chairman does not seem to be sympathetic.
He is not. So far you have merely made things worse, and I would not be surprised if, when he comes back, he calls these proceedings to a halt.
Bailey shook his head and stared at his shoes.